The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of 1041 KQTH or the EW Scripps Company.
Since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America. They fought to end slavery. They joined with allies to win two world wars. They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord. Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces. The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide at 1041kqth.com. To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Hello and welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, BBG. I can remember the precise moment that triggered my interest in military history. It was my sophomore year in high school, and we were assigned book reports. I chose a book called 1,000 Destroyed, The Life and Times of the 4th Fighter Group. I was hooked. Throughout my high school years, several model airplanes were suspended from my ceiling by fishing line, the P-51 Mustang and the F-4U Vought Corsair among them, selected because they were some of the best Allied fighters during the Second World War. There was another plane in my ceiling gallery, one which was not as fast or as maneuverable, but as the others, it just looked really cool. It looked like what I thought a fighter plane should look like, especially with its distinctive shark-toothed decals on the nose of the plane. It was the Curtiss P-40. While the P-40 saw combat in various World War II theaters, those that bore the shark teeth and the men who flew them have become part of military legend. They were the American Volunteer Group, more popularly known as the Flying Tigers. Joining us today to tell their stories, attorney and author Sam Kleiner. Welcome, Sam. Sam, we got you?
Yep.
Okay, welcome, Sam. Well, Sam, let's start off real quick. I know we're talking to you from all the way across the country, but how on earth does a litigation attorney with a background in international trade come to write a crackerjack book about a World War II flying unit?
Well, I hope crackerjack is a compliment.
It is. Honestly, I just finished reading your book this morning. I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Great, great. Well, I'm glad to be here and be able to talk with your listeners about the book. My grandfather was a navigator on a B-25 in the Pacific during World War II, so I kind of grew up with this deep interest in World War II. He lived up in Tacoma, Washington, but I grew up in Tucson, and he would come down frequently, and we'd go out to the Pima Air and Space Museum and talk about planes. And I soaked up every, you know, book I could get my hands on in, about World War II at a pretty young age. And did graduate work at the University of Oxford on this early period of World War II, right around the beginning of World War II, and focused on U.S. foreign policy, and came across the story of the Flying Tigers, which was, as some listeners may know, is a secret unit that was sent over to China actually before Pearl Harbor to assist the Chinese in their ongoing fight against the Japanese. That was really just an incredible story that jumped out at me, and as I was reading about it, I found there wasn't a good book out there about it. So I figured that it was time that someone try and write one. And so at the time I was in law school at Yale and started doing my research there actually, and discovered that there, one of the two women who'd been in the Flying Tigers was a nurse who had done her degree at Yale, and her papers were in the basement of an archive. So I went down there and wanted to look it up, and discovered this incredible trove of love letters between her and a pilot. Their story kind of captured my attention. I said, I really want to tell this from the human perspective. What was it like to be part of this famous unit? And spent the next few years traveling across the country, working with the family members of the Flying Tigers, and met the last Flying Tiger, a man named Frank Lazonski, who lives down in Columbus, Georgia, and collected a massive amount of combat reports, diaries, letters, newspaper articles to help build what I hope to be the definitive story, entirely true, of this incredible unit.
Well, Sam, let's jump right into it, because the name of the book is The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. We've got about 5 minutes before we have to take our first break, but let's start with two of the characters, not the right word, two of the persons that are central to this story. Let's start off with a man that started it all. Not unlike many of the World War II commanders, a somewhat controversial guy, but also had great foresight. Tell us about Claire Chennault.
So Claire Chennault is kind of the center of the story, and he's this incredible. He had been an early Army stunt pilot. He's from the backwoods of Louisiana. And he was controversial in the Army Air Corps in the 1930s because he had very different views on aerial tactics than most of his commanders. So he was down at Maxwell in Alabama and was writing stuff that was not well received by his commanding officers, and was basically being forced out of the Army Air Corps, and met a Chinese Air Force officer at an air show in Miami. And he invited him to come be an advisor to the Chinese Air Force. And at first, Chennault turned that down. But eventually, in 1937, he accepted that offer. In his diary, he refers to this as the Great Adventure. And he basically gives up everything he's ever known. He's mostly lived in the South, has never really left the U.S. before, and goes over to China and spends the next 4 years helping the Chinese in their war with the Japanese as an advisor to the Air Force. And it's, you know, a lot of listeners might be familiar with the Rape of Nanking, but the war was, even beyond that, was a massive devastation through aerial bombardment of Chinese cities. And Chennault really fell in love with the Chinese people. He had built a great relationship with Madame Chang, the wife of Chiang Kai-shek, who was kind of overseeing the Chinese Air Force. And he then came back to the U.S. in 1940 with this idea, working with Chinese officials and American officials, to secretly send 100 American pilots, 100 P-40 planes, and a couple hundred ground crew and other persons to secretly support the Chinese Air Force. And this all had to be off the books, had to be kept off the record, because America was still neutral in the war with between Japan and China.
Okay, well, so Sam, now slow down. You're getting ahead of me on the story here, brother.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of the core of the story, but he's a larger-than-life character.
And I've just busted your chops. I can tell you have a passion for the story as well. But it's interesting to me, historically, though, Claire Chennault was in sort of that period when aviation as a air power, as a tactic of modern warfare, was evolving. He had a vision for what fighter planes could do. The concept was the bombers will always get through. That was sort of the accepted doctrine. But Chennault felt a little bit differently, and also at that time, the technology, the aircraft were catching up with what he needed to do to fulfill his plan. We've got about 2 minutes before the break. Tell us about the other character. Chennault's relationship with Madame Chang, that really was the glue that sort of held this whole thing together, wasn't it, Sam?
Yeah, absolutely. And Madame Chang is such a fascinating character. She's an American-educated woman. She went to Wellesley and went back and married Chiang Kai-shek. And, you know, they kind of shared power. So newspapers of the time referred to her as the most powerful woman in the world. And she took a special interest in the Air Force, and they had a string of different kinds of foreign aviation advisors. Some were Italian, Australian, American. But she really came to believe in Chennault and Chennault's vision for what they could do. So they were in some, you know, the fighting was absolutely terrible. The Chinese had pretty much lost the core of their air force. And this was kind of the fascinating story.
Well, I tell you what, when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about how Claire Chennault built this interesting group of pilots that were to become the Flying Tigers. Folks, as your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, BBG, we're joined live on the phone by Sam Kleiner, the author of The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan.
Those those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live on the telephone by Sam Kleiner. Sam has got a great book out about one of my favorite groups, a lot of folks' favorite groups during the Second World War, the Flying Tigers. Sam, we were talking before the break about getting approval for Claire Chennault, getting approval for this concept, being spurred on by his friends in China. His newfound friends in China, but, you know, waging a secret war against Japan on behalf of the Chinese, easier said than done. Claire has to get planes and pilots to Burma. Let's start with the pilots, because there's some fascinating stories there, Sam. Some joined for the money, but most joined for the adventure, didn't they?
Yeah, most of these guys were young pilots in their 20s who were in the armed forces. Many of them had scarcely left the cities they were from. This is an era in the Great Depression when a lot of these guys, you know, grew up without much money. And so when they got approached about the opportunity to go to the other side of the world and participate in real combat, that was quite appealing to them. So I read about pilots like Bill Reed from Marion, Iowa, who writes in his diary right when they get on the ship to cross the Pacific, this is the first time that he's been on a body of water bigger than a lake back home. And so for many of these guys, this was they were much more adventurers than mercenaries.
Now, the pay they've been promised, though, is not too bad either. I think they were, correct me if I'm wrong, Sam, $1,000 a month plus a bonus for every plane. Well, at least initially, a bonus for every plane they shot down.
Yeah, they were their salaries were about triple what they were earning in the U.S. Armed Forces, and then the pilots were promised an additional $500 bonus for each Japanese plane they shot down. So that was quite compelling, obviously, and for some of them that was obviously a big motivator. I write about a pilot who listeners might be familiar with from his role later in the war, Greg Pappy Boyington, who became famous as the Black Sheep Squadron. But he actually started out with the Flying Tigers, and the story with him was that he was actually in a pretty bad place. His wife had left him and taken his kids. He thought he was going to be kicked out of the Marine Corps, and he stumbles up to the bar at a hotel in Pensacola, Florida, where he was stationed, and he orders a drink and starts talking to the guy next to him and talking about, you know, how everything in his life seems to be going wrong. And the guy says, well, it's your lucky day. There's someone upstairs who's recruiting pilots to go to the Far East to fight against the Japanese. And Boyington downs his drink and goes up to talk to the guy. And he says, you know, in his memoir, he doesn't really believe what the guy is telling him. But, you know, he just wanted to get out of there. So he signed up and drove across the country and got on a ship to go over to the Far East. So these guys joined for an array of reasons. And for many of them, it was just a big adventure.
Well, and Sam, that's what I love about your book, The Flying Tigers. It's replete with these stories that even people who are passionate about these guys and the Flying Tigers probably don't know. I mean, your research is outstanding. In this particular scenario, as I understand it, you know, Chennault had recruited a fellow to recruit pilots. He knew of a bar where a lot of pilots hung out, so he kind of just went down there and was sort of just spreading the gossip and the rumors. And I don't know if it's coincidence or fate, Pappy Boyington wandered into that very same bar, and this guy's like, hey, head upstairs. I got a guy who can help you right now.
There weren't that many pilots in the Army at the time, or in the Armed Forces, and there weren't that many bases, so it was pretty easy to do. And it was supposed to be secret, as we talked about, because of the sensitivities around this, but it quickly got out that this was happening. And so there was actually an article in Time magazine about these secret convoys that were going to the Far East. And I write about one pilot, R.T. Smith, who's sitting in his barracks having a drink, reading Time magazine. And he reads about this and says, that sounds a lot more exciting than sitting around here. So he calls up through some friends and finds out where the recruiting's happening and gets in contact with a member of the organization. And then he gets on he ends up joining as well. So, you know, it quickly kind of spread. They end up with around 100 pilots and a couple hundred ground crew. Mm-hmm. And they end up in Burma is where their journey really started.
Listen, before we jump to that, Sam, let's talk about the equipment part of things.
Absolutely.
You know, getting early in the book when you talk about Chenault and the training he's doing of what was then the supposed to be the Chinese Air Force, I mean, they're flying anything they can, lawnmowers with wings, biplanes, not that many monoplanes. So getting aircraft that can take on the Japanese was well, it involved a lot of intense lobbying. And they started off, as I understand it, with basically the leftovers from the British, right, with these P-40s?
Yeah, these P-40s were kind of an export model that we had been sending to other to European countries, made up in the Curtis Wright factory in Buffalo, where I'm actually going up to do a talk next week. And the P-40 was not a beloved plane, far from it, but it was good enough to get the job done. And Chenault understood that he really needed to just kind of get whatever planes he could and get over there. So they found these P-40s that were available and decided that was good enough. So they sent them over on a ship, and that's how it kind of got started. But that was, they were hoping to get bombers and more mm-hmm. planes later on. But after Pearl Harbor, that was about all they got.
Well, I tell you, you know, Chenault's story is both a riveting one and in many cases a sort of a heartbreaking one, too, as far as what this man achieved and the disappointments he faced. But the quote-unquote secret part of this, Sam, to me it's very interesting in the context of what was happening pre the U.S. getting into the war, the politics, the statecraft. One of the disputed issues surrounding all of this was the extent to which President Roosevelt was actively involved in this or not. Could you enlighten our listeners a little bit on what you discovered?
Yeah, and Roosevelt, you know, was in a very tough position before the war because he was actively committed to aiding the Allies. He talked in one address about how America should be an arsenal of democracy, and he mm-hmm. wanted to ensure that the British and the Chinese were adequately getting supplies to as they fought the Axis powers. But he was obviously quite hamstrung by a very isolationist Congress. And so through notes that were taken at these meetings by Secretary of the Treasury Robert Morgenthau, we know that Roosevelt did personally sign off on this idea of sending over American planes and pilots to assist the Chinese. So this was a secret operation that was authorized at the highest levels of the White House.
Well, so, again, part of my, this, we got planes, we got pilots and ground crews. Next thing you know, we've got about 300 personnel boarding these freighters. And folks, I'm using the air quotes, my fingers here, missionaries and farmers depart San Francisco on these freighters for the Far East. One of the examples that made me chuckle in your book, Sam, aboard this freighter, in addition to the Flying Tigers flying under an assumed role as missionaries, were some real missionaries, and probably the least choir boy of all the Flying Tigers, Pappy Boynton, was apparently actually invited to give a sermon one Sunday.
Yeah, they all had to travel over under false passports that listed fake professions because you couldn't have 100 pilots traveling across on these merchant ships, on these commercial ships to the Far East. And then say, you know, these are all pilots who are going to fight against the Japanese. So they would use these passports with professions like missionary, but Boynton quickly was kind of outed as not being a real missionary because they ended up on a ship going over with actual real missionaries.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so there's definitely an aspect of espionage to the whole thing.
You know, it's interesting, I didn't realize this, but Boynton, I mean, he wasn't even very well liked by the folks in the volunteer group, was he, eventually? I mean, he just had some real challenges.
Yeah, he had a lot of challenges as he made his way through the Flying Tigers, and most of it was kind of that, you know, his contemporaries would say that he was a bit too fond of the bottle, and there wasn't a lot of discipline in the unit, which was kind of to Chenault's liking, but mm-hmm. Boynton definitely pushed the outer limits of what was acceptable in that unit.
Well, ironic or maybe not that later on when he was commanding the Black Sheep Squadron, that sort of lackadaisical discipline and structure, Boynton carried that forward, despite not liking Chenault.
Absolutely. That's I kind of think they're almost too, you know, sometimes people are too similar and they end mm-hmm. up hating each other. And that was kind of the case for Chenault and Boyington. They were both a little, they ended up having a very strained relationship. And Boyington left the unit early. But it was, they're both fascinating characters.
Well, so they finally arrive and they're getting set up and I don't know if they, well, I don't know, who knows what they thought they were going to expect, but their accommodations were not quite as luxurious as they might have dreamed of, huh, Sam?
Yeah, they end up going over there. They were promised kind of these luxurious accommodations. And they get over there and find that they're actually in this remote jungle in Burma in a base called Tongo. And that was really not what they had signed up for. But they quickly learned to kind of love their new environment, and they started training on these P-40s because most of the pilots had ever flown a P-40 before because it was strictly an Army plane. And so I'm writing a lot about the kind of experiences they went through, and there wasn't a lot of discipline. So it was, you know, it felt more like a fraternity party than an Army unit. There were drinking whatever they could get their hands on, going in and partying in Rangoon, and this the love story that I focus on a lot between the nurse and the pilot really blossoms there.
Okay, we'll come back to that. We got about a minute before the next break, though. So explain something to me because I'm not real clear. So Chenault was over there training Chinese pilots, but when the American volunteer group arrived, were these integrated squadrons, or was it strictly just? What happened to the Chinese pilots when the Flying Tigers, if you'll pardon the pun, took off?
So after Pearl Harbor, they quickly went into combat in both Burma and in China. Their first battle is in China on December 20th, and we can talk about that after the break.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. I'm joined by attorney and author Sam Kleiner. Great stuff coming up. We're going to start off with, how did the Flying Tigers get those famous shark teeth on the noses of their planes? Stick around.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. My producer and I just got so we're sharing your book, Sam. We're getting excited talking about this. Oh, we got to do a show. We got to get back to that. Are you ready to go, Sam?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, other Sam. Sam in studio, Sam. I want to play the listeners a clip here because one of the things that made me smile again about your book as we went through it, Sam, is this rapidly became the worst kept secret in the world, definitely in the Pacific. Let me know when you're good to go with that. You're ready? Okay. I want to play a quick clip for our listeners here.
Republic Pictures presents The Flying Tigers, a timely picturization of the story of those brave volunteers who blaze a new path to glory. John Wayne is the leader of the Flying Tigers. John Carroll is friend, cocky, irresponsible, and both in love with Anna Lee.
Why don't you go home?
You need a nurse. Suppose you cut yourself shaving.
Sam, that picture of the Flying Tigers was John Wayne's first war film. It was released in 1942, pretty quickly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. It was basically a propaganda film. So one of the things I want to clarify, Sam, in reading your book, because I was never clear about this, the Flying Tigers never actually engaged the Japanese until after the attack on Pearl Harbor, correct?
Exactly right, and that's why listeners need to, even if you think you know the story of the Flying Tigers because you've seen the John Wayne movie, you need to actually get the book because the John Wayne movie is not really factually accurate. So
Stop. A movie that was not, wow.
Fake news. but it's a great movie, so I also encourage you to check it out. But the Flying Tigers quickly became the most sensational story across the country right after Pearl Harbor, because they were already in place, even though they hadn't yet engaged in combat against the Japanese. Mm-hmm. So they rushed into combat in December of 1941. Their first battle is on December 20th, 1941, over a city called Kunming, China. And they beat back a bombardment from the Japanese, shoot down a number of Japanese planes, and that becomes big news back home. Time magazine does a piece on them, and they quickly become these overnight heroes. So the pilots that I'm writing about, just these young men from back home, from their local communities, quickly become the most famous members of the military across the country. So this really becomes a sensational story. And Hollywood obviously recognizes a good storyline and rushes out the Flying Tigers movie with John Wayne.
Well, and this was America needed some good news. I mean, we pretty much got our clocks cleaned at Pearl Harbor. It looks like nobody could stop the Japanese. And here's this American volunteer group, kind of swashbucklers of the air, that are the ones that are first doing that. It's interesting to me in hearing that the preview there, Sam, it sounds like the characters, I haven't seen the movie, but it sounds like the characters are based on a couple of real life storylines that were taking place. Tell us about Emma and that romance that she had with the Flying Tiger.
Yeah, and we just, listeners can check it out today. There's a big excerpt from the book about that point in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, because she's actually from Pennsylvania, but Emma Foster was a young woman who was from Pennsylvania originally, went to Penn State, and then became a nurse, and she'd actually studied abroad in China while she was an undergraduate and fell in love with China and wanted to go back, and so she got this invitation to be one of the nurses for the Flying Tigers, and without knowing much about it, signed up, and then on the ship over, she met a young pilot from New Jersey named John Petak, and they quickly developed this romance, fell in love, and were separated actually after the fighting broke out in December 1941, and would write these long love letters back and forth to each other, and those letters were basically hidden away in this archive for 75 years, and then I found them, and so that's an important part of the story to me.
There's this cast of characters that you described as sort of a combination circus troupe fraternity party flying out of the jungles of Burma there. What inspired me about this, Sam, as I mentioned the book 1000 Destroyed early on in the program in the introduction, I saw some parallels between the Flying Tigers and the 4th Fighter Group. Kit Hoffer, one of my favorite, one of the original screwball pilots. He wore his hair long. He flew in a football jersey. He had a propensity to just go, chase on the Luftwaffe all across Europe. There was a member of the Flying Tigers also who was a cartoonist who decided to, he wanted to experience what he was drawing. Is that the Reader's Digest version?
It's one of the most fascinating parts of the story is, each of these pilots is fascinating in their own right, but this young pilot named Bert Christman is a really remarkable young man who had originally got his start in New York City as a cartoonist working for the Associated Press. Had worked on cartoons about kind of adventuring airmen, which was a popular topic in the 1930s, and then decided that wasn't enough for him, and he actually wanted to learn how to fly, so he joined the Navy. And then when the invitation came to join the Flying Tigers, he and a couple of his best friends decided this was too good to pass up, and this was his chance to really experience this firsthand. And so he signed up and then was in kind of diving in to combat in January 1942. And quickly discovered this wasn't something that was appealing to him, and wrote home about how he wished he could come home and just do more cartoons, but then was tragically killed in February 1942.
I want to emphasize that because for people who are just on the surface familiar with the Flying Tigers and what heroes they were, your book also reveals the very practical realities of what they were doing. They weren't quite behind enemy lines, but they started off with 300 personnel, a number of aircraft, but supplies and replacements were not readily available. I mean, pretty much they were stuck with what they started with. So when they lost a pilot, when they lost a plane, it hurt more than it might have, let's say, some of the squadrons over in Europe who, had a ready supply of replacements.
Absolutely. So they had these original 100 planes. They lost one that fell into the harbor right when they got over.
Hmm.
And then they were trying to, kind of get as much as they could to assemble the rest of the planes into a strong fighting formation. And they were constantly losing planes in these various battles, and that really hurt their ability to be an effective fighting force. So it's remarkable what they did, period, and it's even more remarkable when you consider what they did while not having any real resources.
Well, and that's, to me, one of the great part of the story, and even President Roosevelt and I think Winston Churchill himself congratulated the Flying Tigers, recognizing that fact that they did so much with so little. Before the next commercial break, Sam, I want to talk about the nose art, the famous nose art. I think a lot of people, they hear Flying Tigers, they look at those nose of those aircraft and assume it's a tiger on there, but it's actually a shark. Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's one of the funny things about them. They were called the Flying Tigers, but they actually had a shark face design on their P-40s. And they actually saw it in a magazine. They were doing all different kinds of artistic designs on the P-40s and then found this design in a magazine. It had originally been on an Australian plane. And they thought it looked great, and they tried it out on one of their P-40s, and then they showed it to Chenault, and he said, I want that on all of the planes. That's going to be our identifying mark. And at the time, of course, they had no idea that that would become one of the defining images of America at war. It was just kind of a fun project for them as they were getting ready for combat. But obviously that image stuck, and you can find it on A-10s today in the U.S. Air Force.
There you go, folks. When we come back, we'll be wrapping up with Sam Kleiner, author of The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. A great read. I encourage you to grab it and read a copy. Sam referenced there are, nose art is falling out of favor with the United States Air Force. When we come back, we'll talk about, real quickly, those A-10s that are still allowed to carry that nose art. Stick around, folks.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard. Till the day that he died, he wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking with Sam Kleiner, author of a great new book about the Flying Tigers called The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots Who Waged a Secret War Against Japan. Sam, you were a very talented individual. You even accomplished what in radio we call the tease just before the break, talking about the, I don't know, you can add that to your resume if you want to, Sam. talking about the nose art on the A-10s. With the advent of stealth coatings, we're just not seeing nose art anymore, and we probably won't, but they're the 23rd Fighter Group. They fly A-10s, and they are the only squadron, as I understand it, that's authorized to have nose art on their aircraft still officially today.
Yeah, it's interesting because the 23rd is actually an heir to the Flying Tigers in the sense that the Flying Tigers became the 23rd Fighter Group of the 14th Air Force after they were merged into the Army Air Corps. So down in Georgia, the 23rd is kind of considers themselves the heirs to this tradition.
Now, Sam, you spent some time growing up in Tucson, so you got to see the A-10s flying out of Davis-Monthan here. I don't know if you made this connection between the P-40s that the original Flying Tigers flew and what the A-10s, the 23rd, is flying now. Not just the nose art, but both aircraft have a reputation for taking a punishing and still returning to base. In fact, one of the quotes in your book that made me smile was one of the pilots that described the P-40. He said, it soaks up lead like a sponge soaks up water. And he meant that in a good way.
Absolutely. It was a bulky, heavy plane, and so Chenault taught them they would have to dive from on top and really engage with the Japanese that way rather than getting into dogfights in which they'd be outmaneuvered. But obviously, as a Tucsonan, a big fan of the A-10, and glad that Davis-Monthan is still up and running and will be for many years to come. And the P-40 is just a wonderful plane. I know they're reconstructing an old P-40 out of the Pimarin Space Museum as well, which I'm looking forward to seeing next time I'm in town.
Well, I tell you what, there's a group called the Heritage Flight that trains every year here at Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, and they combine aircraft from different generations, and one of the flights they have has everything from, you got a P-47 Thunderbolt, its grandson, if you will, the A-10 Thunderbolt, and then they throw in an F-16 or an F-22 or an F-35, and they fly in formation. It's quite the sight to see. So you might want to plan your next visit, Sam, to coincide with that. Let's talk a little bit about sort of the end of the American Volunteer Group here. I don't want to say it's a sad story, but to a great extent, Claire Chennault was the victim of his own success. I mean, at some point, the regular Army says, hey, either time to join up or get out of Dodge.
Yeah, they eventually were being kind of forced to merge into the Army Air Corps. And so they took that up, and the choice was kind of given to the pilots. You could either sign up or head home. And so most of them decided that because of friction with the Army Air Corps, they wanted to head home and would rejoin their own units. So I write about how they were received when they got home. Pilots like Bill Reed from Marion, Iowa, returned home to a parade unlike anything that town had seen before. And it was really just a remarkable experience for these young pilots to have, to be welcomed home as heroes. But obviously this was still in the midst of the war, so a lot of them were then kind of forced back into further combat, and Bill Reed ended up returning to China, and he was killed there in 1945. So there's obviously a lot of sadness that comes with a lot of these guys not making it through the war.
Well, and there was some tension there towards the end, because there was a window during which, you know, Chennault announced to his flyers that he had accepted, he was going back into the Army, and they had to make a decision themselves by July 4th, an auspicious date there. But some of these pilots are saying, oh, wait a minute, we don't know what we want to do. We don't know if we want to take some risks. It got so bad that a number of the pilots actually signed a petition. There was almost somewhat of a little revolt there, wasn't there?
Yeah, when the fighting got really bad, they were being given instructions, actually, basically by Stillwell to fly these very low-flying missions mm-hmm. that were incredibly dangerous. There was what they called the Loing Revolt when they were down in a town called Loing, and a bunch of the pilots said, we're not going to fly these missions. Chennault came down, they handed him a resignation letter, and he had to kind of stomp it out and keep them in line, but they basically stopped doing those missions. So, you know, a lot of what I'm trying to do is, you know, there's a lot of, you can find kind of the hagiographic story about the Flying Tigers in other books that are not as well researched, but, you know, I wanted to tell the real story. And, you know, it's not always perfect, but it's deeply human. You know, it's these guys were going through a lot of different emotions.
Well, it was very, considering what they did, I think a lot of them, what I take from your book, Sam, is a lot of them went over there for the adventure. Many of them went over there for the money. But as they got to know the Chinese people, as they witnessed personally the atrocities of the Japanese, one of which was featured in the movie, and you reference it in the book, the Japanese had this, I don't know if it was a policy, but they certainly had a tendency that when a pilot bailed out, they would strafe him in his chute. And at least one of the Flying Tigers was killed that way, survived getting out of his plane, but was strafed in his chute.
Yeah, that's what happened to Bert Christman, the cartoonist mm-hmm. that we talked about. And so there's definitely a lot of, and that actually made its way into the John Wayne movie. So there was a lot of, you know, very harrowing experiences that happened to this unit. The story is, you know, full of a lot of different sad chapters, but I think on the whole it's really about the perseverance of these mm-hmm. guys, you know, really on the wrong side of the world fighting against an enemy that was really overwhelming.
Well, I tell you what, they may not have had the parts and most of the training, but they certainly weren't lacking for grit. One of the first things in your book made me smile, I think it was in the introductory chapter before the American volunteers got there. You were talking about a Chinese-American pilot that was flying over there, ran out of ammunition, rammed the Japanese plane with his aircraft, destroying both, bailed out, and when he landed, he went and grabbed his machine gun off his crash plane and marched back to the Flying Tigers and said, "Please, sir, may I have another plane to go with my machine gun?"
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a great story. So there's a lot of those kind of little nuggets of great bits in the book, and I love when readers can connect with an individual moment like that.
Oh, what a great! I mean, you can't script stuff like that, Sam. So only, as I understand it from your book, only 5 pilots and 29 ground crew members agreed to go back into the formal Army. At midnight on July 4th, the American Volunteer Group passed into history. The numbers that we have, these are Chenault's figures. They had fought unsupported for 7 months, destroyed 299 Japanese planes with another 153 probables, which in comparison to some of the squadrons flying in Europe weren't large numbers, but in the context of these men, what they did and what they did it with, still pretty outstanding.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really, you know, the losses were obviously quite severe, mm-hmm. But they, you know, on the whole, had a really incredible tenure. There's a lot of debate over how many Japanese planes they shot down. I don't really come down on that in the book, except to say that I think whatever that number is, somewhere between 115 and 297, is an incredible accomplishment, regardless.
Well, and clearly tactically they achieved. Their mission and slowing down the Japanese and maybe even redirecting some offensive operations by the Japanese. What, Sam, we got 3.5 minutes left. Let's sort of wrap this up. Chenault, again, I find his story somewhat of a sad story in that he never really adjusted again back to the regular Army, if you will. He had some battles of his own with the bureaucracy.
Yeah, he had a very tough time with the bureaucracy, and so he kind of he came back, and really I don't think he felt at home anymore in America. He mm-hmm. tried to go back to Louisiana, and he was certainly hurt by the fact that he wasn't invited to the surrender ceremony on the Missouri. So he then turns back to China, basically, and spends the rest of his life serving Chiang Kai-shek, even as they lose the Chinese Civil War and are forced to retreat to Taiwan. And so it's really a harrowing experience that he goes through.
Well, and unless I read this incorrectly, he was credited or is credited with forming the predecessor to which became Air America, that also not very well-kept secret airline.
Yeah, absolutely. He started an organization after the war called the Civil Air Transport, which actually was kind of an update of the Flying Tigers. They bought old Army planes, transport planes, and then they secretly became part of the CIA, essentially the air branch of the CIA, and were faring around missions throughout Southeast Asia in the 1950s. So the first Americans to die in Vietnam are really CAT pilots who were flying in missions into Dien Bien Phu in 1954 while the French are garrisoned there. And so you kind of see a way in which the Flying Tigers and this idea of having kind of covert operations becomes kind of the mainstream of how foreign policy is conducted, and that CAT then becomes Air America.
Well, and Madam Chang, ironic to me, Sam, that she lost China not to the Japanese, but eventually to her own countrymen. She died at the ripe old age of 105 in New York City. And the Flying Tigers themselves, what, half a decade later, half a century later, were finally recognized for their role and got some medals and some recognition.
They were finally recognized in 1991 for their as actually being an official Army unit or military unit. So that recognition was long overdue, and I think a lot of them never felt like they got what they were owed in terms of official acknowledgement. So it meant the world for me to be able to come along and give them what I think is a very overdue amount of credit with writing this book. And became very close in the process of writing this with family members who said that the book allowed them to understand more about what their families, mm-hmm. family members went through than they had understood before. And just a couple months ago, I was able to go down to Columbus, Georgia, and see my friend Frank Lozansky, who's the last surviving Tiger, and give him a copy of the book.
Well, Sam, congratulations. Very well done. Folks, I encourage you to get a copy of the book. It's called The Flying Tigers, The Untold Story of the American Pilots. who wage a secret war against Japan. I think Sam's kind of a softy. He read those love letters from the nurse Emma. You need to read the book to find out what happened with her in her life. Thanks for tuning in, folks. You can find this podcast and others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. If you want to support us, go to Patreon.com, P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com. Look for American Warrior Radio, and you can support us that way. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place.
The right weekend shows at the right time.
All of our weekend show info can be found at 1041KQTH.com.
It's 1041KQTH HD.
KQTH Tucson.